Dallas. Israelis and Palestinians are marking 2 years since the October 7th, 2023 Hamas attack on Israel. Almost 1,200 people were killed. About 250 were taken hostage. 48 hostages remain in Gaza, with 20 believed to be alive. In Israel, a moment of silence was held today to remember the victims of October 7th. For Palestinians, today marks the start of a third year of a genocide that's left much of Gaza uninhabitable. The official death toll in Gaza surpassed 67,000, but that number is believed to be a vast underestimate. More than 460 Palestinians have starved to death as famine spreads across Gaza. About a quarter of them are believed to be children. An estimated 2,700 Palestinian families have been completely erased from the civil registry over the past 2 years. On Monday, ceasefire talks began in Egypt over President Trump's 20-point plan that includes a call for the swap of all remaining hostages in Gaza for Palestinian prisoners held in Israel, as well as an eventual Israeli military withdrawal from Gaza. But major questions remain over what both Israel and Hamas will agree to. We begin today's show, this segment in Gaza. We're joined by Ad Amawi, representative of the Gaza Relief Committee, coordinator for local NGOs based in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. We tried to reach you yesterday, but had technical problems. Ad, describe what's happening on the ground.
Thank you, Amy. I hope also the ceasefire will be implemented soon. But the real situation here over the ground, nothing tangible change. But they halt some huge bombardment attacks and explosive robotics. But yesterday night, they returned attack a shot camp in the western part of the Gaza City with a huge bombardment, and caused more than, within the last 48 hours, more than 50 martyrs and more than 50 injuries. So the situation is something like stabilizing the current situation without a huge bombardment for all hours, but still attacking between time to time. And also they sieged Gaza town and prevent the coastal road and prevent the return of the civilians again to the Gaza City. And they announced officially they prevent Al-Rashid Street used by our displacement people to return to the Gaza City. So the situation is just constant and stabilized with the current situation, with no tangible changes over the ground here. And also there is no withdrawals from the encouraged area around the Gaza City, especially, and the east part of Rafah and Khan Yunis. So the situation is just stabilized like that.
And Iyad Amawi, could you talk about the dire need for not only for food, tents and medicines, but actually, as you're mentioning, for water? If the plan is adopted, who will control access to the border crossings, and who will ensure that the humanitarian aid gets in?
Yeah, this is a big question, Mayor. You know, there is no nothing now clear for us as NGOs or local NGOs to coordinate the distribution of food, but the needs is really worsening more and more. There is nothing entering Gaza, especially within these days when they announce hard attacks. So our needs, especially, we need more than 600 trucks day by day for our to meet our humanitarian needs. But, you know, until now, there is nothing over the ground clear how we can deliver and how can we distribute the bin. But, you know, in the previous time, we have old mechanism with cooperation with NGOs and UNRWA and WFP and other organizations. So in my thoughts, we will depend over the very well-calculated policy with international community NGOs, and we can manage that as compared to the previous ceasefire agreement that back from the Israeli occupation forces.
What about your response to what Trump has proposed and the fact that Trump supposedly told Netanyahu to stop the bombardment of Gaza during this period of the negotiations, but he's refused?
Yeah, we welcome with any peace agreement that will bring peace for us, especially when the Mr. President Trump announced that. And we welcomed, really, we feel with the mixed feelings, with the worries, with the happiness, with the sadness. But the reality over the ground, still the situation worsening and going, because the heart of attacks is not complete. So we hope that a ceasefire agreement will completely implemented and we can reinforce our society here and renew the life and return the hope for our civilians and children also.
Thank you very much for being with us. Iyad Amawi, representative of the Gaza Relief Committee and a coordinator for local NGOs based in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As we continue to mark 2 years since the October 7th attack on Israel, we're joined now by the Israeli peace activist Maoz Inon. He lost both of his parents, Bilha and Yaakov Inon, in the Hamas attack. His parents lived on a kibbutz, a farming collective just north of the Gaza border. They were 78 and 76 years old. Maoz Inon has spent much of the last 2 years calling for peace, working closely with the Palestinian activist Aziz Abu Sada, whose brother died in 1990 from injuries he sustained in an Israeli prison. In May 2024, the two of them met Pope Francis at the Vatican. Last year, Maoz wrote online, "True security will only be achieved when the other side also enjoys security and stability. Morally, we cannot justify the killing of innocent people as part of the fight against terrorism. The harm to hundreds of innocent civilians is neither reasonable nor acceptable. These efforts should bring an end to the war in Gaza, return the hostages and the occupation, achieve a political security agreement alongside reconciliation," Maoz Inon wrote, and is joining us now on Democracy Now! From Tel Aviv, I believe. Or where are you, in Binyamina?
Binyamina, in my hometown, in my home, yes.
Our condolences on the death of your parents 2 years ago. What are your thoughts today as thousands of Israelis call for a ceasefire and return of the hostages in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem?
So first, Amy, thank you for reaching out and having me today in your show, but for all your and Democracy Now! Support in me and my family for the last 2 years. It's a very, very sad day. It's a very sad day because so many lives were lost in the last 2 years. Of course, my parents, among them, they were among the first victims of the Hamas attack. But so many lives were lost. And I'm just very sad today. But I'm also, and I want to say my thanks and appreciation for all those Palestinians, Israelis, and from all over the world that are reaching out to me today and sending me amazing messages that they are thinking about me, about my parents, about their legacy, and that I'm, and those who knew my parents also saying that they are sure my parents would be very proud from the work me and my siblings are doing to end the war and to start a reconciliation and a peace process.
And Miles, could you talk somewhat about your parents and you say as your legacy? What do you think their thoughts would be on this 2 years of this war since the October 7th attacks?
My parents, first, I had a really amazing parents. They were supportive, they were loving, they were caring, proud of the five of us. I have three sisters and one young brother. And they were very, very much involved with the life of their grandchildren. They had 11 grandchildren. Now from the age of 3 to 21. And even though they weren't young, but they were in the prime of their life, my father was working full-time as agronomist and a consultant. My mom was very creative and active artist. She was painting mandalas in her studio and teaching from young children to adults to elderly people who would come and be inspired by her art. And their legacy and my parents' legacy is combined of two main fundamental values and lessons they taught us. My mom was very creative and believed in the power of dreaming. She believed that we can fulfill all our dreams if we have the courage to chase them. And she gave us the courage and the ability to dream. and my father, who for 58 years was sowing wheat in the fields of the Negev. And it's very difficult to be a farmer in the Negev. And during every day, he was sharing about the devastating situation in the field. If it's because of drought, because of floods, insects, wildfire. But while he was sharing how devastating the current situation is, he would always say that next year is going to sow wheat again, because next year is going to be a better year. But it's up to him. He has the agency to change the future. He must learn from his mistakes. He must consult with others. He must fertile the land, get the best seeds. And so knowing, not with belief, not with faith, so knowing that next year, next season will be a better year. And now it's our turn to sow the seeds of peace, the seeds of reconciliation, the seeds of equality, knowing that next year and next season will be better.
Mao Zinon, we want to thank you for being with us. Award-winning Israeli peace activist lost both his parents, Bilha and Yaakovi Inon, in the attack on October 7, 2023. Coming up, Palestinian journalist Plestia Alakad, author of the new book, The Eyes of Gaza, A Diary of Resilience. Stay with us.
When my way grows dear, precious Lord, linger near. When my life is almost gone. Hear my cry, hear my call, hold my hand.
The late great Odetta performing in our Firehouse studio, September 11th, 2002. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with Plestia Alakad, award-winning Palestinian journalist. She was just 21 years old when Israel's bombardment of Gaza began 2 years ago. Her online videos went viral, were seen around the world. This is a video from October 9th, 2023.
For my neighbors, they didn't evacuate as well. They have their windows down. Here are their windows. And here is the family. They're gathering all together, also in a place far away from the wind. I was trying to explain things, but I think you can hear them now. I'll go check on my parents.
Plestia Alakad now has 4 million followers on Instagram. She's just published her first book. It's called The Eyes of Gaza, A Diary of Resilience, based on excerpts of the diary she kept in the weeks after October 7th. On October 19th, she wrote, quote, "This isn't an aggression anymore. It's a genocide. There isn't another word that can describe the scale of violence I see in front of me." 2 weeks later, she wrote, quote, "Every night, I wonder if it will be the last of my life. Will there be a tomorrow? I try to look at my family, to gaze at and memorialize their faces just in case." Plestia Alakad joins us now from a studio in Beirut, Lebanon, where she's studying media. Plestia, thanks so much for being with us. You know, you left us in that video talking about checking on your parents. It was a devastating video because as you were speaking, there were bombs going off outside. You opened the window and you showed it was just a cloud. You couldn't see beyond. Talk about your experience of the last 2 years.
Unfortunately, Israel succeeded in isolating and dividing Gaza from the rest of the world, meaning your experience as a Gazan Palestinian person living in Gaza is different than your experience if you're living elsewhere. For example, kids in Gaza grow up afraid of the sky. When you look at the sky in Gaza, you can't differentiate, is this a cloud or is this smoke? The whole time you're listening to the sounds of drones, quadcopters, airstrikes and bombs. You can't even listen to the sounds of birds like any other normal person. And even the air that is in Gaza, it's polluted because of the bombs and airstrikes and everything. And in Gaza, when you see tent is like displacement, a cold place, it has a negative meaning. But outside of Gaza, tents are usually something nice. Oh, let's go camping, let's use them for the weekend. And that's Gaza's experience for 2 years. They've been displaced, bombed, trapped, and starved deliberately by Israel in Gaza.
And by your metric, as you write in your diary, quote, I am four Israeli aggressions old. Can you take us back to that day, to the 2 years ago, to the beginning of the Israeli attack and the toll it had taken on you and your loved ones?
History didn't start on October 7, 2023. It's been 2 years of the genocide, but it's been 77 years, if not more, of the ongoing Nakba that started in 1948. I remember on October 7, when I woke up, I listened, like, I heard sounds of bombs, and I slept again, then I woke up again. I immediately, like, jumped out of bed. I went, I saw my mom. She was already on the phone calling the delivery guy, we want bread, we want flour, we want this and that. And this is a tradition that I know. Whenever I see like a family member doing that and ordering these stuff, I know that's something bad about to happen. I then looked out of the window. I saw how full and crowded the streets were and the supermarkets were. Like everyone is just out buying stuff and so on. And I knew that something bad is happening, but I never expected that it will be a genocide that lasts for 2 years.
And you also write at one point in your diaries, quote, priority number one, aside from not getting killed, is connecting to the internet so I can update my Instagram. Can you talk about the difficulty of being able to get out the word to the rest of the world of what was happening?
As a journalist, you're supposed to be protected because you're a journalist. It's a profession. You're doing your job. But unfortunately, in Gaza, journalism is apparently a crime, and Israel is targeting and killing journalists. Around 270, if not more, journalists have been killed. And the reason I'm saying if not more, because how are we supposed to know the up-to-date numbers if the people who are also counting the number of dead in Gaza are also getting killed and targeted? I wrote that on Instagram because as a journalist, my job was super difficult. Like even connecting to the internet was a challenge. And even like charging your phone, charging your cameras, finding a power bank, all of that was challenging. You were experiencing the genocide, living it, knowing any minute you'll be killed and targeted, yet you were trying to tell and show the world what's happening, even though you knew that that puts your life at risk.
Plestia, last year, Amnesty International Australia gave you its inaugural Human Rights Defender Award. I wanted to play a compilation of your reporting from Gaza that they highlighted.
It's around 4 p.m., no electricity, no water, no internet. Literally just the sounds of bombs. I'm standing right now inside the first refugee camp in Gaza Strip. I'm at Al Nasser Hospital right now. There are 80 premature babies in the NICU room. Yesterday, the Israeli warplanes targeted a church where around 200 civilians were inside. These are the equipments for a journalist that got murdered by the Israeli forces. As you can see, we can hear the sounds of bombs right now. But day by day, I'm surprised by things I see. Even during a genocide, a war, ethnic cleansing and displacement and everything, I tried to show the Palestinians living in Gaza who they are, how they are kind to one another, how they are nice, even during these difficult times.
That's Plestia Lakhad reporting from the ground in Gaza. The BBC named her in its 100 Women of the Year list. And now, a few years later, I mean, Plestia was 21 at the time. She has a new book. She has a first book, The Eyes of Gaza, A Diary of Resilience. If you can talk about what those 45 days were like that you're covering in this book of your reporting then, you're studying now media in Beirut, but can you talk about your decision to leave and what has happened to the rest of your family?
It wasn't really a decision to leave Gaza. What options do you have? It's either you stay in Gaza and wait to be one of the thousands that are killed, or if you're lucky enough, you get the chance to leave, because not even everyone has the chance to leave if they want. The borders are closed, and you need to have another passport. You need to have, like, a cousin, family member who has another passport to be able to help you out. So even leaving Gaza is a privilege that not everyone can afford or can have. When I was in Gaza for 45 days, I thought it was the worst days of my life, and I thought, oh my God, like, I can't believe this is actually happening. But what I didn't know that the genocide will still be going on for 2 years. My colleagues, my cousins, my friends, most of them are still in Gaza. They're still on the ground. The journalists are still reporting. My friends are still trying to survive. So my experience of 45 days is nothing compared to the experience of the people who are still there and trapped in Gaza. But the reason I chose to write this book, The Eyes of Gaza, is because I've always had a diary. Writing is what I usually do. And for the first time, I wanted it to be us writing about us, not just some people speaking over us and writing about our experience. I wanted us to have our own voice. We already have voices. We just need help in amplifying our voices, not in replacing our voices. So I made sure to write a book written by a person from Gaza to the world.
And Plastia, in that diary, you also talk about hearing of the solidarity movements of young people and students around the world. And you write, quote, "It's beyond what I ever imagined. Here's the thing. The students aren't just calling for a ceasefire. They're also calling for the establishment of the right of return and insisting on a Palestine that is free from the River Jordan all the way to the Mediterranean Sea." Talk about this, the impact of these protest movements on the people of Gaza.
Honestly, as a Palestinian person, the bar has always been low. The expectations has always been almost non-existent. But right now, the world proved us strong. Millions of people worldwide are protesting. They now know our names, they know our stories, and they are amplifying our voices. I'm honestly beyond proud and impressed, especially with the younger generations who are making sure that the genocide doesn't go unnoticed, and they're super vocal and outspoken about it. And right now, the global Sumud Flotilla and what they're doing, what Greta is doing, what all the other activists are doing, how they're literally risking their lives just to deliver aid in Gaza. And even though aid wasn't delivered, their message was delivered, and it gave Palestinians hope. Because Palestinian people were not expecting from the rest of the world, oh, pause your life because we're getting killed. But what we're expecting is solidarity and to be seen. And the world has proved to us that we are seen and that they're standing on the right side of history. And for that, me and all the other Palestinians, I'm sure we're all very grateful.
Plastia, could you read your poem Only in Gaza that you include in your book? If you don't have it with you, okay. If you could talk about it.
I have it with me. Okay. So for me, this poem is still a poem in progress, like it's not finished yet. And I hope one day I'll continue this poem and it will be on a positive note, a hopeful note, where the situation in Gaza would be so much better. Only in Gaza, you sleep counting rockets rather than stars. You wake up, if you woke up, on the sounds of birds rather than... Okay, I need to repeat. Only in Gaza, you sleep counting rockets rather than stars. You wake up, if you wake up, to the sounds of bombs rather than birds. Only in Gaza, you sleep not knowing if or how you'll wake up. In Gaza, you sleep in your house and you wake up under the rubble. In Gaza, you sleep with your body parts whole and you wake up missing a hand or a leg. In Gaza, you sleep beside family and friends, and the next day, you are on your own. Only in Gaza, people celebrate birthdays while war echoes in the background, then welcome you into a tent with warm hands and a cup of tea. Only in Gaza, despite the pain, people remain, not just survivors, but warriors.
Lestia, reading Only in Gaza, which is included in The Eyes of Gaza, a diary of resilience. Plestia, you say that you prefer to write and to speak when talking about Gaza in English because you find it less painful. Can you talk about that?
English is my second language, not my first language, so I obviously understand Arabic more, and the weight of Arabic words always hits differently because it's my mother tongue. So I feel like whenever I speak in English, I can hide behind the language. That's number one. And number two, I want the whole world to know about what's happening, especially that international journalists are not allowed in. And that's why I made sure since day one to speak in English to make sure everyone knows and sees what's happening in Gaza and to not limit the audience to Arabic-speaking audience only.
And could you talk as well about the community of journalists that are still there covering the war, the comradeship and the bonds that you built together?
One thing I always wonder is who reports on the reporters? Journalists and reporters in Gaza are living the genocide while also reporting it, are facing starvation while also reporting on it. They're reporting on stories of families who lost loved ones while they're also grieving as well. I feel like the most difficult job in the world right now is to be a journalist in Gaza because they're trying to be a journalist while they know they'll be targeted, they know they're not safe, they know they're putting their family's life at risk just because of a profession they chose, and all of that just to show the world what's happening in Gaza.
And can you comment on the number of Palestinian journalists, among them most recently Anas al-Sharif, but more journalists have been killed since Anas was killed. But what this has meant to you and the people you've lost in your life?
I'm honestly in disbelief of when journalism has become a crime and instead of being a profession. So I don't understand how is it possible for the world to watch journalists getting killed, and where's the international committee of protecting journalists? Like, is there anyone who's going to do anything about it?
And what would you hope for the rest of the world to take from your book and your experiences?
So my book is my story and the stories of other people that I meet along the way, and I make sure to mention their story and their name. At some point, the book will make you cry, will make you laugh, will make you joyful, will make you tearful. So I just hope people will do something with all of these emotions, because emotions alone are not enough. Emotions are only powerful when you convert them into actions.
Your book includes the dedication to Gaza, the soul of our souls, all I am and all I will ever become is for you and because of you. Do you hope to return, Plestia, to Gaza?
Of course, I always hope. Of course, I always hope to return to Gaza. And I find that a very weird question when people ask it to me, because it's not like it's even an option right now. The borders are closed. I can't just go back right now, even if I want to. People can't leave even if they want to. And I can't go to any Western country easily. I need a lot of paperwork and visa processes to be able to go. But these people who have powerful passport can go to my homeland. Meanwhile, I'm just stuck in here. I can't go back home, and I can't travel to any country that I want. So I just find it a bit weird
how
almost in every interview people ask me, do you want
to
go back?
Thank you so much for being with us, but the show is ending. Plestia Alakad, The Eyes of Gaza, is her new book.
Greetings, netizens. Join us every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific for Bitcoover FM, featuring the best in chiptune, video game soundtracks, synthesized music, history of electronic instruments, and more, right here on CGSF 90.1 FM. We'll see you in the virtual plaza, and remember to synthesize with nostalgia.
listening.